Welcome to BCFM's Metro Mayor Hustings Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and joining me for a full 2 hours until seven are most of the Metro Mayor candidates. That is to say, for the Green Party, Darren Hall, Labour's Leslie Mansell, Liberal Democrat Stephen Williams, and UKIP's Aaron Foote. I'll be putting a variety of questions to them all about current affairs, their role as Metro Mayor, and asking them to share their wider values for a just society, and about how to spend our money, which is mostly what these mayors are about, with the main responsibility for housing, planning, adult education and transport. The Tory candidate Tim Bowles is accompanying a government minister at a secret location here in Bristol today and wasn't sure when he'd be here, be free, or even if he can make it at all. So we have an empty chair here for him today. Also, Theresa May is possibly going to be empty chaired in the general election too. Worth noting, the Conservative Party declined to participate 2 years ago in our 2015 general election hustings on this show as well. Also, at 2:30 today, I got a number withheld call from someone saying they spoke for independent candidate John Savage. He wouldn't disclose his name or his role, but he did say John Savage would be at a hospital trust meeting until 6:30 today, so wouldn't be able to come. I asked who I was speaking to, and he told me his name was irrelevant. When asked whether John would have time to do the Metro Mayor job properly whilst working for the Hospital Trust, he told me I was a conspiracy theorist, then put the phone down. I subsequently confirmed John Savage wouldn't be available today with Zara, his publicist. One of the questions I wanted to ask John Savage was how open he would be as Metro Mayor, because all of the requests I've put in to interview him as chairman of United Bristol Hospitals NHS Trust, spending around £500 million of our money every year, have been refused. And as a former master of the Merchant Venturers, it would have been interesting to get his views on Edward Colston and this week's announcement of the Colston Hall name change. So first, let's get to know the candidates and ask each of them to explain what the Metro Mayor is all about. Just to complicate things, Bristol's third mayor, this is, after the Lord Mayor and the City Council Mayors. It's known officially as the Combined Authorities Mayor. And if you are wanting to find out who the Combined Authorities are, that's tough. Their website is down for maintenance. They say, luckily though, that we have some people here who we can ask. A 2:30, as I said, John Savage announced he couldn't make it here, and also we haven't got Tim Bowles, the Conservative candidate, who's looking after a government minister, we're told. So let's have a round, first of all, a sort of introductory round with some first questions, starting with UKIP's Aaron Foote. Now, UKIP, whose idea is this Metro Mayor? What's their annual budget, and what will you do if you're elected?
Obviously, the annual budget's going to be £30 million, and it was an idea from the local government and national government to devolution powers from centralised government back to the people. We already have this Metro Mayor system in place. It is combined so far with the three local authorities, well, four actually, including North Somerset, which have decided not to get involved in this Metro Mayor.
So why is it, you think, that North Somerset have decided not to? Actually, you're from that part of the world, aren't you?
Well, I'm from over by Yate, Bristol, work, and then obviously I work, and I'm not sure of this. I work over the border in Somerset, literally in spitting distance from Leslie. And, it's a lovely part of the world.
So why is it, do you think, North Somerset have decided they're not interested in this being part of this Metro Mayor? And taking some of the money, I would imagine. They're probably losing money out of it.
Technically, they've said they're not going to be part of the devolution deal, so therefore they're technically not part of this £1 billion project over the next couple of years. And they're also not part of this £30 million devolution deal. But I think they listen to their voters. In North Somerset, possibly, and the Conservative-led coalition, well, the Conservative council over there listened and voted against it.
So, for the Lib Dems, Stephen Williams, whose idea is the Metro Mayor? What's the budget, and what will you do if you're elected?
The genesis of this was back in 2014, during the days of the coalition government, when actually Michael Heseltine wrote a report for the coalition called No Stone Unturned, where he recommended that instead of England's great city regions bidding to central government every year, quite a demeaning process really, to ask for sort of crumbs off the table from central government, instead there would be an annual grant from central government to the city regions so that they could spend that amount as they pleased. But in order to have oversight of that, there would need to be some political accountability. And it was also partly to address the sort of democratic deficit in between Wales, Scotland and the city regions of England, because we were considering this this at the time of the Scottish referendum. So as Aaron just said, the extra money, and this is what people keep getting wrong, the extra money is 30 million a year. I'm going to go wrong myself. 30 million a year, so 120 million over the four-year term. But the big potatoes aren't that. They're the devolved transport budget, which could be hundreds of millions, and devolved control over the some part of the skills budget, which is about 166 million a year as well. So actually, big powers, housing, jobs, transport, skills, and a big budget too.
How about you, Labour's Leslie Mansell? What's your take on this Metro Mayor, what the annual budget is, and what the purpose is?
Well, hi, Tony, and hi to all your listeners. My name's Leslie Mansell. I'm the Labour and Cooperative Party candidate for Metro Mayor. The idea came from George Osborne, so it was his baby. And what we're going to get is more money and more powers. And I think it would be really good to talk a little bit more in depth about what those are. If you want to find out more about the Metro Mayor's role, then do check out on my website, Mansell for Metro Mayor, and you'll find a very simple question and answer sheet there. But the role itself is to do with, initially, housing, transport, skills for people over 19, and also the economy. And we know what we've got here in this part of the world, the west of England. We have got the wealthiest part of the country outside of London, and yet we've got a massive situation where we've got a big gap regarding skills, regarding how people get on in life. We've got a situation where women earn less than men, worse than anywhere else in the country. Black people earn less than white people. So that's what some of this should hopefully address.
And what about you, Darren Hall, for the Green Party? What's your idea of where this came from? It didn't really seem to sort of bubble up from the bottom, from the citizenry. It's come down. We've heard George Osborne's name mentioned. We've heard Michael Heseltine's name mentioned. This is their kind of brainchild, it seems. But what do you think you'll do with this budget if you're elected?
Well, I'm actually going to look even further afield in that other cities in Europe, particularly in Germany, have been able to help the German economy much more so than cities in the UK. And economists here were looking across the water and saying that looking at other countries in Europe, then their economy was better balanced across the country, whereas what we know in the UK that basically it's London plus a little bit, and we in the west of England are the only bit of the UK economy outside of London which is a net contributor to the Treasury. Now hopefully we can continue to do that and do better, but other areas in the UK, the Northern Powerhouse that people are talking about, that's the sort of the devolution agenda was all about, saying back to government, well, if you want us to do better, you need to give us more freedom in what we can do. So the big bit for me about this devolution agenda is the ability to raise money locally and spend it locally.
OK, I would also say that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, thanks, Leslie, for mentioning your website, but I'll put up links to all the candidates' websites on there. So if you want to check out what they're saying now agrees with what they're saying on the internet, you can do that. And also you'll find out a lot more about what is the purpose of the Metro Mayor ultimately. A little bit of a quick round now. I want to ask you all, starting with you, Stephen Williams, why was there no referendum about this? When we had a mayor for Bristol, it was quite a big hoo-ha. Everyone was asked, do you want a mayor? This time we've just been told you're having a mayor.
Well, that was a decision made by... the genesis of this, as I said, was under the coalition government. Of course, the actual legislation to create the six that are going ahead was done under the current Conservative government. And while they were an enthusiast for a referendum on the European Union, which I think was a dreadful mistake, looking at my UKIP colleague right opposite me in the studio, they obviously decided not to have referendums on devolution. Because let's face it, one of the things we know is that the public never votes for extra politicians. I think we've all encountered on the streets, there is huge scepticism about whether we need extra MPs and so on.
We voted for the mayor, didn't we? The Bristol mayor.
Yes, and in Bristol was the only city that did, and I think that was probably a lesson for the government, that generally if you say do you want more politicians to run things, they quite likely say no. I'm trying to give an honest explanation, trying to second guess what the Conservatives decided, and this was an important opportunity to get devolution right baby steps, but to start making those steps inside England, and we didn't want to falter again. Let's face it, the reason we're in this mess is because 17 years ago, the northeast of England rejected devolution in a referendum. That's why only London has got devolution in England. I would not want us to wait another 17 years to get devolution in Bristol, Birmingham and elsewhere.
I mean, they've had a mayor in Manchester, I think, haven't they, who wasn't actually originally even elected. He was just appointed.
They've done the pilot, yeah.
Leslie, what's your take on why the people of this area, Bristol, Bath, northeast Somerset, south Gloucestershire and north Somerset, weren't actually asked, do you want a Metro Mayor?
Well, there was a consultation. There wasn't a fantastic response to it. There were responses to it. I think it was something like over 1,000 people. So there was a consultation, and then the four local authorities discussed it, and they decided whether they would sign up to it or not. North Somerset decided not to, but Bristol, Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloucestershire decided they would.
Darren,
and that was June last year.
Darren, do you think there should have been a referendum on this, whether we have a Metro Mayor or not?
I'm not sure about a referendum, but I think it was important that there were democratic processes that people could have got involved in. But the reality is that no one saw this coming beyond the political bubble. And I think it would have been another case where people were voting for something they didn't really understand, like the referendum we've just gone through. So...
Yeah, and also maybe very few people would have voted, like the one for the Bristol mayor. It would have been a bit embarrassing in the referendum. It almost says, well, actually people aren't really interested anyway. Aaron Foote for UKIP.
I think we can look at referendums all the time. We can look at Bath last year, where they had a referendum for a mayor and they rejected it. The people don't necessarily want more bureaucracy. What they want is actually democracy, and this is why I'm standing on a platform of e-democracy and letting people have their say. The consultation period was done. It was absolutely dreadful response, as I would see. I think we should have a minimum cut-off on consultations. I think it should be at least like 5% of the population respond in certain areas. We didn't even hit that. And I think personally it should have been consultated a lot more and a lot widely.
Okay, back to you, Darren, for this next one. Less than half the electorate are likely to vote next week because there aren't any normal councillor elections. We're doing them all I think it was last year. They're being done all together now. So why is that? Why are we expecting less than half the electorate to actually vote? And what would you do to address this voter apathy?
You're right, there is voter apathy. I think there's voter fatigue now, not least of all that we've called the snap election. But I think it's on top of the fact that there's a real worry around people turning away from democracy in general. They see it as... They don't trust politicians, they don't trust the processes. And to be frank, actually, if you, even as someone who's keen on democracy, when you turn up to a lot of these political meetings, council meetings, and there's huge stacks of paperwork, and they're long and really quite dull processes, it is very hard to get involved. What is good is that young people are starting to get energised again. Young people are starting to say, hang on a minute, you are... I was going to say a rude word there, with you are messing up our future, and we're not happy about it. So I think that is one way. That another way is, as you know, the Green Party want to bring down the voting age to 16. I think we should be talking to young people about democracy much more fully and sooner in schools to make people understand about it. But having said that, there'll be a growing understanding. This is the first four years of hopefully a long process of greater and greater devolution. And I imagine that by the next time we come to vote on this, there'll be a lot more people that want to have their say.
Yeah, Leslie, it's worrying when people don't actually come and use their vote after all the efforts that have gone in over the centuries to actually get the vote for people. What do you put this down to, and what would you do to make convince people that it does make a difference voting?
I think on the one hand, what we saw with the EU referendum, that people were confused. And if you look at the booklet that came out, the Remain campaign had sourced all of their information, but the Leave campaign had not. So there is an issue there about how much of truth was actually told. People got very confused, they got very fed up, and actually 37% didn't vote at all. But what we're now meeting on the doorstep is people are starting to be enthused, especially now the snap election's been called. But I've been out on the doorstep now since January, along with other Labour Party members, and I'd like to say a big thank you to them, as well as all the union members that have been out, because we are starting to find people are first of all, understanding a bit more about the Metro Mayor and the devolution and the deal, but also they're starting to engage a bit more, and that's only got to be encouraged. But it's hard work doing that. The media, parts of the media, especially community radio, have been playing a massive part in trying to raise the profile. You can't say that happens right across the media, though, I would say.
Okay, Aaron, your turn. What do you make of this voter apathy? It's pretty awful if, you know, up to half the electorate actually aren't going to be voting in this Metro
Mayor. Agree with you. It's awful, and it needs to be sorted. And I think that we can look at the fact that people are getting fed up. They keep going to the polls, and nothing's changed over a couple of years now. Every year we seem to have some form of election around here. And as I'm finding out on the doors, people just want things sorted. And I personally would love us to see actually amalgamate some of these elections. Why can't we suddenly put Parliament on 4 years along with Council and roll everything into one? I know it's going to be absolutely hard for party politicals to fight these battles, but let's actually change the democracy. Let's have an open debate and see where we want to go in the future.
Stephen?
Well, let's not second guess what people are going to do next Thursday. And I think part of the job of all the candidates sat around this table and the presenter as well, Tony, is to enthuse people about why it's important that they should vote, because these are big issues that the Metro Mayor is going to be responsible for. Responsible for economic prosperity, job creation, land allocation for housing, franchising the bus services, reopening railway stations, controlling the apprenticeship levy, adult skills. These are huge issues that touch every single household right across the west of England. And I think I have been really frustrated, I have to say, Trevor Pop and another media outlet with the BBC, the Bristol Post and all the rest of them for waiting so long, right up into early April, before they started explaining to people what this role was about. And they've known it was coming for a year. And that's why this is the first time that I've ever stood in an election. I think this is election number 10 for me, where I've had to spend most of the start of a conversation with a voter saying what the job is rather than what I want to do with it. And I don't think any candidate wants to be in that position. If you stand for Parliament, people have an idea what an MP does. Stand for the council, they know what a councillor does. Standing for this position, I've had to say, well, this is being created for this reason, this is the responsibilities and so on. And frankly, the media should have done all that for us. And it's really annoying that we're in this position now, even though we're only 6 days away from the election.
Now, Leslie, we've heard that this is going to have a roughly a £30 million a year budget, £30 million extra, we're told. So that's around about the equivalent of the £30 million Bristol City Council cuts. Can you see why Bristol, why voters think that this may be a con? It's just shifting the money from one part of the public services or one part of government to another?
Absolutely. I can understand people being very frustrated with that, and it almost correlates, doesn't it, the cuts at Bristol Council. But it doesn't just cover Bristol, does it? It's also Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloss. But there's a huge opportunity here for the new Metro Mayor to make a big impact and do things differently. And what I want to do is precisely that. I want to make sure that whatever the money is spent on, it's spent in consultation with people so we can agree priorities together. That what we do is transparent and that there's an impact that is measurable, that we can show that. I think with a lot of government spending, it goes into places, not quite sure where it goes, not quite sure where it does, what it does. So, for example, we know at the moment that £500 million are being spent from the public purse nationally on homelessness. Wouldn't it be better to build council houses than spend £500 million on homelessness?
Darren, what do you make of this? £30 million a year budget, but we're being also told that £30 million has been taken away from Bristol City Council.
Well, for me, it's down to this ideology of the Tory government, which is about everything being economic growth. So what they want, they don't really care about putting money into what they regard as the bottom of society. They want to sort out the top. So they're quite happy to strip money away from the foundations of society, put it into economic development. Business then creates tax, an amount of tax goes in, and then it trickles down to the people who need it. Now, you know, after years of this process, we know that what's happening is the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and it is not narrowing the gap. Now, one of the things that we need to go back to government about, once we get into this process, is say to them is they can't just look at economic growth as the criteria for success of this devolution agenda. They have to be looking at a much wider understanding of what is a prosperous, good society.
Aaron,
just say very quickly, this trickle-down theory on the economy. What seems to have happened is gravity has failed because it's not working, and people are not paying taxes in this country. They're paying them outside of they're putting their money into tax havens. If we had that money here, then we could afford the public services.
Well, and also, of course, most of the big companies are doing exactly the same. In fact, I have to say, most of the big media companies, they keep much of their money. People like the Daily Mail and Sky, they keep it out of the country. And the Guardian, as we hear. Anyway, Aaron, £30 million pounds we're taking with one hand and giving with the other.
Yeah, it's all out of the same pot, and let's not forget this. We haven't got a new, fresh pot. It's not a new, fresh £30 million come from nowhere. It is all out of the same hole, and yeah, I can see why people in Bristol are annoyed, and I would be if I was a Bristol resident person.
Stephen, what do you make of this? People looking at this saying, actually, the figures just make it look as if you've shifted a bit from one budget to another away from the City Council.
Well, I can see why people might say that, particularly for cynical journalists. Tony puts a thought into their minds. They might not have thought of it otherwise. But to be honest, these are completely different responsibilities and completely different budgets. All of what the regional mayor and the combined authority is going to be doing is currently done by ministers in London, mainly by the Department of Communities and Local Government, where I was a minister, and the Department of Transport and the Department of Business and Energy. Those powers are now coming here, and they come in with quite a lot of money. Hundreds of millions of pounds is coming to this area so that we can decide how we spend it, or the regional mayor and the three leaders of the councils on some occasions can decide how that money is going to be spent. That, I think, is a major step forward to how we've run this country before. So, rather than be cynical about it, I think we should welcome it, get out and vote, and elect the best person.
Darren, are you pleased to see this week's announcement that Colston Hall will be changing its name? And if so, what should it be changing its name to?
Well, this is it's an important conversation, and I think where I stand on this is, there's two sides to it. One is that we have to acknowledge what went on. We have to keep that current. It's a clear and present issue in Bristol that is across. In fact, I've just come from Cabot Tower, another issue, if you like, and these are dotted around all over Bristol. So it's right and proper that we're having the conversation, but I do wonder whether changing the name of something is the best way to deal with the overall conversation. But having said that, at the end of the day, I think it's right and proper that the organisation are looking at it. I think it's good that people are getting involved in the conversation, but I don't think it's part of the. It's for Metro Mayor candidates to wade in and on one side of the argument or the other.
Okay, Aaron Foote, Edward Colston was a slave trader, made much of his money through trading in slaves. Finally, it's been decided in Bristol that it's not appropriate to have our main concert hall named after him.
But there's other places, and we've got to look at this. And should we be changing history? I don't think we can. We should be educating and looking forward and saying, well, we've already said sorry for our mistakes in the past, and let's move on. And personally, a name doesn't always work. We've got to look at other companies that have been rebranded in the past. Look at BT, they changed to Openreach and that failed. People still remember the previous history. We've got to remember the fact that it just changing a name doesn't eradicate history.
I mean, just one thing I can remember from a few years ago when they were first building Cabot Circus, they were going to call it Merchant's Quarter. Yes. And there was an absolute hoo-ha with various people, yes. including the guy who was the chair of HTV, he was a merchant venturer as well at the time, the nice chap, saying, no, this is not appropriate. Anyway, Stephen, what do you make of this name change?
I applaud Louise Mitchell and the Bristol Music Trust for doing this, because they knew it was going to be hugely controversial whenever they did it. And I'm glad they've given effectively 3 years' notice before it happens, because the Colston Hall will shortly close for a major refurbishment, and I think is going to reopen in about 2020 as a fantastic new auditorium for the city. And that would be the right point to give it a new name, because it will be a transformed venue. I agree with Darren, though. The way you deal with painful history, and that's what Bristol's involvement in the slave trade is, ought to be painful for all of us, even those of us who are only current generation Bristolians, is to acknowledge it, interpret it, discuss it, and understand it. But there's no reason for people who currently live in the city to feel guilty about it, because slavery was something that was perpetuated by rich white men 250 years ago. So there's no reason for current Bristolians to be made to feel guilty about it. And a lot of oppression, a lot of terrible behaviour towards Irish people, for instance, was done sending them to the plantations at the time. Lots of people were executed for stealing apples. The past is a horrible place, frankly, when you go that far back. And there's a lot of things that we don't acknowledge properly. And when I was a young councillor in the 1990s, it was me, and before Leslie explodes, there was a Labour councillor called Pat McLaren, and we were the two people who persuaded Bristol City Council at that point to put a display in the Georgian House on just off Park Street on Great George Street, because there was nothing there to acknowledge the fact that the Pinney family, who owned the Georgian House, got their fantastic wealth from sugar plantations in Nevis. And that little display, which is in the attic on the top floor, hasn't changed, I think, since 1996. And Pat and I were the people who were on the Leisure Services Committee at the time who thought it was a good step forward. And then to get a major display into what was the new Empire and Commonwealth Museum. So I've been involved with this for a long time. And I think, personally, that this may be controversial. Probably some people won't like this. The Edward Colston statue, now that we're about to finish the Metrobus works, should be moved. I think it should be put inside the museum, inside either the Art Gallery or M Shed, with a proper display around it about the role of prominent Bristolians in this dark period of our past.
Not in the basement, then.
No, because that would cover it up. And people need to understand it.
Okay, and also, I mean, you know, one would have thought that there might be some statues to the people who helped end the slave trade, campaigners here in Bristol, for example. Anyway,
Clarkson, yeah.
Leslie, what do you make of this? Is it something that you think is important, Colston Hall having its name changed, and if so, to what?
Well, I welcome the actions of the Trust, and I think the issue really is that we make sure that we don't perpetuate discrimination, and I don't see anywhere where we've made a major move where we haven't done that, and that's a bit of a worry. So if you look at the Cabot ship, the Matthew, it was faithfully rebuilt a few years ago with £1 million worth of money, and I believe John Savage was involved in that. And while black people in St Paul's are saying, but we want jobs, they were told, oh no, we can only spend this money on a ship. So instead of doing something more positive with that money, and I don't disagree, it was a nice ship, but the history of that ship and what it did in the triangular trade was absolutely outrageous. There was no apology given to black people, and no representation, no reparations were given to black people, although it was all given to the landowners. The plantation owners got money as a result. So I think one thing we could have done, and one thing did happen after the building of the Matthew, was that there was an exhibition in the museum on the slave trade, but that is no longer there. Liverpool has got a permanent exhibition, so why not here in Bristol?
Well, it's worth mentioning, isn't it, that the Empire and Commonwealth Museum, after they did their amazing, actually it was quite an impressive exhibition on the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery, was promptly closed down. Anyway,
for another name, if you want another name, for a start, there's lots of black people in this community who the Colston Hall could be named after. People like Zara Hack at Deck Bar, people like Rosa Hoy in the Chinese community. Why we got a Chinese.
Okay. Anyone else like to put a final bid in for
What about Jimi Hendrix? He played at the Colston Hall.
Darren, anyone else, Stephen or Aaron, anyone else like to have a final bid for the new name for the hall?
It's a bit of a minefield, this. I think the Colston Hall is actually named after, it's not named after Edward Colston, of course, it's named after the fact because it's on Colston Street. If only when they built it in the 1860s they'd used the back door and called it Trenchard Street. I think the Trenchard Hall sounds quite nice.
Okay.
But no doubt Trenchard did something dreadful I don't know about.
Okay. Staying with the merchants, this is a bigger question, really. Do the city's merchant venturers have a role in making Bristol a better city to live in? We'll start with you this time, Leslie.
Well, I'm not sure of their role entirely. They're sort of a bit of a secret society, aren't they? Clearly they do have a role in the way that big business does. But what we don't do is ensure that all businesses are involved, or whatever type they are, whether they're community interest companies or voluntary organisations. And this is one of the things with the Metro Mayor. And what I want to see is how we bring all these different organisations together so we can look at how we get the best for everyone rather than getting just something for a few.
Aaron, we've got this organisation, the Merchant Venturers. They've been around for hundreds of years. Yep. Actually, as we were pointed out, as was pointed out on this programme a few months ago by one of the professors up at the university, actually, they were the same families that financed John Cabot in his original trip to the United to discover America, even though the Native Americans had already discovered it hundreds and thousands of years before. What do you make of this society, which actually, one of the interesting things about the Venturers is that they won't publish their accounts because they're a charter incorporated under a royal charter, I'll try and get it right, they don't actually ever have to publish their accounts, so we don't actually know even how much money they've got.
And they have, they funded all sorts of activities and stuff in and around Bristol. They funded schools and stuff like that around here, and to be honest, I actually went to one of the schools that they did fund locally, and we can't deny the fact that they have funded fantastic things since. And I think what we've got to look at is how we can play with, like, play the role further and open up more transparency and accountability in that. They fund massive projects throughout Bristol and the surrounding area. Let's actually see what they do and open it up for transparency and accountability.
Yes, it's a shame that John Savage couldn't be with us, as he's a former master of the Merchant Ventures, and he would probably have been able to tell us if he'd felt he wanted to, how much wealth they actually had. Anyway, Stephen, what do you make of this question about the role of the Merchant Ventures in Bristol?
Let's keep this brief. I think we're going slightly off topic now. I've always struggled with them, and I used to describe them to people as sort of uber Freemasons, really, a cut above Freemasons even, because they were very small secretive society. I think there's only about 25 of them at any point in time. Until relatively recently, it was entirely male. I suspect at the moment it's still entirely white. They do control hundreds of millions of pounds in terms of assets, physical assets and cash, in the city. They do some good charitable work, undoubtedly. They have, and this is something I would welcome, recently, though, realised that they've got a problem, because, you know, they had heaps of criticism in the 90s and noughties from lots of investigative journalists, including yourself, Tony. I remember Venny used to turn them over, a magazine I miss a lot in Bristol on a regular basis. So they have done things such as sponsor the Merchants Academy in Hartcliffe in South Bristol, and have started to get involved in the trickier aspects of education rather than what they've traditionally done, of course, which is they are the body that sits behind many of the city's private schools. And sounds as though I may be in a minority here, and certainly amongst Aaron and Darren as a comprehensive school oik.
So. Okay, one of the things I would point out, you mentioned Freemasonry, I love it when people bring it up and they're not me, is that the merchants have exactly the same system as the Masonic lodges do, where you start with the master is the master of the Merchant Venturers. You've also got the senior warden, who will be the master next year, and the junior warden, who will be the master the year after that. And those wardens are supposed to be, anyway, in charge of enforcement. In other words, they'll come and knock on your door, what are you up to, kind of thing, and they will get promoted to be the master in 1 or 2 years' time. But anyway, Darren, what do you make of this question? Do the merchants have a role making Bristol a better city to live in?
I certainly think there is a role for philanthropy. There is a role for charitable giving. It's just a shame that those processes seem to be picking up the gap left by funding, the lack of funding from government, and we seem to be going in that direction. For me, what would be more... Well, the more worrying bit is the soft power, that quiet influence that's going on in the background. So I'm more worried about the use of and the misuse of power than I am about the money. Having said that, you know, Bristol is one of the most unequal cities in the country. We've got rich and poor, cheap and agile, with things like 10-year differences in mortality and 20-year differences in good, healthy lives. And I don't feel as if some of those projects have that are, you know, rebuilding and to schools, yes, great, but have really gone to the heart of tackling that wider society inequality. So... I think there are bigger issues that should be done more publicly to more fundamentally tackle the inequality.
Leslie?
I just wanted to add to what I was saying earlier on about getting all the different organisations together, because Darren was just talking about the funding gap. A number of voluntary organisations are finding that their funding is being cut because of the cuts to the local authority. So projects like the Brigstow Project, which supports people with HIV, projects like Terence Higgins Trust, and also Freedom Youth itself, which I was chair of for 5 years. You know, the worry is, and it's not just those projects, the worry is that those projects are going to disappear, and yet they provide a valuable service at a lower rate that can be probably provided everywhere else. But when you try and raise funds for those organisations, and I've been trying to do that, I know how difficult it is, but when you start talking about philanthropy, they're not the flavour of the month organisations that's going to pick up that money. They're not seen as being, I suppose, deserving enough projects, and especially not when it's HIV. It's a bit better now than it used to be, but lots of things, the discrimination, the homophobia and all the rest of it, has not gone away.
Let's move on to talk about some of the direct responsibilities you all have, starting, I think, with you, Stephen, this time. This is housing. You've got a big job because last time I looked, there were nearly 20,000 people registered homeless just in the Bristol area. And of course, we're talking about a much wider area than that. You need to build something like 15,000 homes straight away.
Yeah, it is a big challenge. The people on the housing waiting list, which is the figure you gave, was not the same as being homeless, of course, and as a much smaller number, wants to move into accommodation that is appropriate for their needs. And we don't have that balance of accommodation available either in Bristol or in the two other local authorities either. For people who want to buy their first home, it is now incredibly difficult to do so, because in Bristol you have to borrow 10 times your salary if you're a young person just starting work. Obviously impossible for people to do. In Bath it's even worse, it's 12 times. So the answer to that is to build more homes of all different types. Homes for sale, homes for the private rental sector, which are properly managed, rather than the rather haphazard way that the private rental sector has usually worked in this country and hasn't worked in the interests of tenants, but also more social housing as well. And the idea I've come up with in my manifesto to address this, because you'll need more state intervention to make it work. If you leave it to the market, we'll be waiting a very long time, frankly, is to set up the largest social enterprise in the West Country, which will look at building homes for sale, for private rental, and will then reinvest the surplus from that into building flats and houses for social rent. And that's how a classic social enterprise should work, and I want to set that up in Bristol and work with housing associations to get the best practice.
Okay, Aaron, this is a hell of a challenge. 15,000 houses, we need them right now.
Yeah, we do, and we can't deny the fact we've got to look at brownfield sites. We've got to build upwards, not outwards, and we have to start building the right houses. We keep building all these townhouses on greenfield sites that are just there for the developers. We've got to move forwards here. We've got to make sure that developers stop land banking, because the only reason they really land bank is to create an artificial market. They're holding back property development so they can increase.
Hang on, man. They're not developers. They're speculators.
Well, they are, yes.
They think they're developers, but they're not.
Yes, we've got thousands of properties that have been passed through planning over the last year, and they've just been held up, and they're being held up on purpose so they can speculate on prices. And we've got to get that moving. We have powers to get that moving. We can just negotiate for one, and yeah, we have the power to purchase act if we have to.
Leslie, big task this, isn't it?
Absolutely it is, and this has been going on for so long now. We've got to a position where here we are in the west of England looking to create 80,000 jobs, and people can't afford to live anywhere. It's not just about buying a property, it's about renting a property too. And what we need to do is build council houses, and we keep hearing this, that everybody's going to build council houses, or houses, and in actual fact what we're building is houses that people are buying as their investment, for their pension. So the harbour side was bought up largely by Malaysians who saw it as a good investment. What's happening is that people are being priced out of the market in terms of renting. And both the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats are saying, well, we need to build more houses. But they've opposed them right across the west of England, and we need to build more. In less than a year, Marvin Rees has already got 1,700 council houses that he's building, and we need more of those. What I want to see as Metro Mayor is we work with organisations like Acorn to make sure we have that fair tenants charter in place. And I'd also want to work with government, and after the 8th of June there'll be a Labour government that we can work with, that we can pressurise, that will listen and do something different about capping rents, about ensuring that people can afford somewhere to live.
Stephen, you wanted to come in here?
Just because I misheard what Leslie did, you say that Marvin Rees has built 1,700 new council houses?
He's got 1,700 planned building in less than a year of being in office.
She's planning to build 1,700?
Yeah, well,
because the ones that were built, of course, were all planned by the previous administration. In fact, going all the way back to when the Lib Dems ran the council.
Can we have
a little
discussion here, maybe very briefly, about how long it actually takes to get through the process of doing this, Darren? A year seems like a very short time to actually, you know, kind of plan, develop and build and then sell or else rent out houses.
Absolutely. So I'm on the board of the Bristol Community Land Trust, and so I've got a reasonable handle on how long it takes to get hold of land, get planning permission, get it designed and get the houses actually built. The reality is that any houses that are being built at the moment are the result of the previous 4 years' work. There's no doubt. The thing that isn't magically going to change as soon as we get into office is the planning system. The planning system needs to be assisted by a presumption in favour of development that has a higher level of affordable units and a higher set of design standards for sustainability. So that's one thing we can do.
But, Cheryl, because a lot of the people who are building houses are saying, well, we're not going to build them unless we can make money at this.
Exactly.
And they're going to be too expensive. In fact, we've got the whole Finsel's Reach thing, where there's some beautiful houses have been built, but even the place isn't being finished off because the existing places haven't sold.
Yeah, well, the myth is that the problem isn't really about the building of the houses. That's the cheap bit. At the moment, it's the land that's the problem. And the only way we're actually going to make these houses affordable is if the public sector is able to put this land into the market basically for free and then become a partner in the ownership of those houses going forward. That way, we will be able to speed up the supply of social housing, council housing, shared ownership, community land trusts, etc. We've also got to stop right to buy. There is no point the state sector and housing associations, thankfully community land trusts were made exempt from the right to buy, but that's another one we've got.
Leslie,
to put stop
do you want
to
come in quickly there?
It's got to be mixed, doesn't it, housing? You can't just have one thing. If it's going to work, it's got to be a mixed situation. I'd like to see cooperative housing, say for students, that would be different. But one of the big issues we've got here is that planning applications that are agreed and then the land is not developed, and in Bristol there's 7,000 of those, and in Baines there's 4,000. So land sitting there just waiting for it to go up rather than actually build where we actually need properties now.
Okay. Also, well worth mentioning that we've just had this week come into effect something we've been talking about on this programme for a year or so, which is this homelessness prevention bill. This is one of those things you look at and it's a no-brainer. It was some research that was conducted by Crisis, and they used as evidence the different legal status of homeless people in Wales. It would cost, they say, nationally £44 million to impose a homelessness duty on council, so they would then immediately help anyone who was didn't have a roof over their head, and that would actually save £47 million, which is the figure which is spent apparently on people who are homeless and who then come to demand other kinds of services. So that's come in this week, which is some good news at least. So planning, housing is one of the biggies, but there's also other wider planning responsibilities you'll have, whoever wins this Metro Mayor contest, and also tidal energy. So let's start with you this time, Aaron. We've got wider planning responsibilities and also the possibility of tidal energy in the Severn.
Yeah, I think the Severn has been overlooked for many years now. I remember talking to family and relatives saying it's going back 20, 30 years of the tidal barrage, and we've now moved on technology. We can not have a barrage and we can actually have tidal energy. Let's look at that. And whilst we're looking at things like that, maybe when it's making a profit, we invest that back into social housing for our homeless. We shouldn't be having homeless people on our streets. It is an absolute disgrace in 21st century democracy that we have people living rough. Let's actually build our social housing. We haven't had enough social housing built now for the last, 10, 15 years. Let's actually have a revolution on social housing here.
Stephen, what about your wider responsibilities for planning, and specifically on things like tidal energy? That is quite a big responsibility. The planning system, a lot of people sort of shy away from it because it's complicated and boring, but it's really about our futures.
Yes, it's a major opportunity, both to join up the planning, the strategic planning, because local planning applications remain with the local authorities, it's important to say that. But the strategic planning, land use for jobs and housing, can be joined up with a transport plan. I'm sure we're about to come on to transport, to get the economy growing in a sustainable way. And one of the areas where I really do want the West of England to be known for in terms of its sustainable economy is sort of green and sustainable energy. We've got this massive opportunity literally on our doorstep with the Severn estuary, and I've put in my manifesto a specific pledge that I will work with the Welsh Government, because obviously the estuary has two sides, to harness the power of the Severn so that we can get clean and renewable energy off into the future for our region.
I think, seem to remember, it was in the mid-late 1800s there was first a design for yes, a Severn right. barrage.
Rather like the Channel Tunnel, these things take a long time.
It does take an incredible amount of long time here. Anyway, Leslie, what do you make of these wider responsibilities, and particularly about the idea of having tidal energy? Because at the moment we've got the, if anyone wants to look at it, there's the biggest tidal energy system in the world right now being installed up at the northeast coast of Scotland, the MayGen scheme, that's MEYGEN, mm-hmm. and you can find some fascinating figures. That has all been brought ahead by the Crown Estates, because they own the seabed and they've decided that we want to make a bit of money here, and so they're leasing out their seabed to the MayGen people to generate power. Is that sort of thing going to happen here, and what about your wider planning responsibilities?
Well, with regard to the MayGen project, I have read up about that because I'm quite very much in favour of sea turbines. Because in this country, we're an island, you could put sea turbines all the way around the coast. We have two tides a day, and providing somebody doesn't shoot the moon out, then that will continue. And we can generate not just enough electricity, but enough for our own needs and have surplus. We don't need a really, really expensive project building a barrage that could then damage the wildlife and the estuary as it exists at the moment. But the sea turbines, it's not new technology. They've had them in France for 50 years. And eventually what we could do then, we can just run in lines onshore that would save us having, ugly things on the shore, ugly buildings. We don't need those. We don't need that kind of thing, when we could have, energy almost for free and make a good use of it. Yeah, I don't see why we should have to go to the most expensive option. And in fact, sea turbines are in my manifesto as well. I think that's what
they said that
forward.
About nuclear, though, didn't they? It was going to be free.
Let's not go there. But just well, I mean, what Leslie just said, Stephen here speaking, that I don't think anyone is seriously proposing a barrage right across the Severn. I mean, the Labour government under Gordon Brown looked at that, and I and a group of Liberal Democrats from either side of the Severn estuary set up a special commission. We took loads of evidence in Bristol and Cardiff and concluded against that, and said that the way forward was to have what's called tidal lagoons, which I think is what Leslie is referring to. So you have sort of onshore,
right,
hugging the coast sort of sea turbines, so you don't affect the ecology of the Severn itself.
Can you just clear that up, Leslie?
It's just a more expensive way of doing things, when, as I say, we could have sea turbines right around the country and have enough power.
Darren, what do you make of this, the idea that we may be using our... We've got one of the biggest tidal reaches in the world in the Severn. It goes up and down more than any other part of the world, apart from Nova Scotia. Now, they've got turbines under the sea there generating power. Why haven't we?
Well, the reality is that it would need a massive investment. And so people...
For more or less than Hinckley?
Well, thank you for raising that. What I was going to say was that, the Southwest is blessed by a great range of renewable energy sources. And actually, I think a mix of them is appropriate, because it's great to get small investment for solar, allowing people to generate their own electricity, and it's great to have major projects as well. And I think that makes it really important. I have to say, I'm absolutely delighted that mainstream politics now most of mainstream politics seems to have completely embraced this idea of renewable energy, and it's now across the most of the parties. Of course, it's our current government who has singularly failed to accept the fact that renewable energy is the best way forward for energy production. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And even in, you know, some of the stuff that's going on in America now with the energy technology on smaller scale for greater and greater gain. The other really interesting bit about this is for Bristol and Bath to become a global leader in some of these technologies, and I agree with a lot of what's said, because if we get on with it, we get a bit of practice, we get some engineering expertise, we learn how to do it, and we can then do more of it across the world.
So will we have to go to the Queen, cap in hand, and say, well, please, can we use your seabed?
I hope not.
I think the coalition dealt with that. I remember legislation going through about that when we did. I think when we did the Green Investment Bank, the Crown Estate technically owns the seabed. But I think that's been dealt with.
But the really interesting moment that is about to come upon us is one, the opportunity to say to government, this is what we want to do locally, and we are going to get on and do it. That's one thing. Secondly, is for the government to realise that they've lost the plot on lobbying from fossil fuel companies, because the world has moved on. So all I can say is bring it on, and thank you, colleagues, for embracing it all.
Okay. That's also,
a bit cheeky, Darren. The Liberal Party and the Liberal Democrats were there a long time before the Ecology Party and the Green Party was formed, saying this was the way forward. So sometimes we have to acknowledge when we agree on something, and not pretend we've joined you a bit late to the party. We've been advocating this for a long time and did a lot in the coalition, which the Tories, and we can agree on this completely, which the Tories now they're in power on their own, are unravelling.
Okay,
because they're afraid of UKIP.
Talking about planning, we've got this thing called the Arena. Is that going to happen? We've got, at the moment, we've got a bridge to nowhere, haven't we, been built over on the far side of Bristol Temple Meads Station. And I wonder if you think that's going to go ahead. Is it something you'd approve of? And would you approve of the idea of spending public money on it? Maybe you first, Aaron.
I think we've got to seriously look at this this sort of scheme, really. We have got to a bridge to nowhere, and we've already ploughed millions of pounds into this scheme, and it's gone nowhere so far. It's similar to the Metro bus, to be honest. We've ploughed 200 million into that, and we haven't currently seen a single bus run on it, and it's delayed by months and months and months. It seems to be that the public sector sometimes doesn't get things quite right, and the private sector sometimes does. Maybe we should look at more private investment and sort it out that way. It's got to be about dialogue. We've got to be open and honest, and we've got to have a transparent system here. We've got to say why we have not so far done it, and we've got to put that out to the people.
Darren, bridge to nowhere, we've got that built, but no arena. Do you think we should be building that? Is that something you would be signing off?
Actually, originally, I was not convinced by a massive new arena on this site, especially when there was the opportunity to develop Ashton Gate as a more flexible solution. So I was kind of a bit confused about why we were trying to do that. I do think there is a role for a flexible venue which could be used for a community, more as a community space rather than a big business outside operator. I mean, of course, we all might like to be able to have big names coming in, but actually Bristol's so much more about its grassroots communities, that amazing culture that comes up. So actually I would have preferred a venue that was specifically built to enhance, generate and grow homegrown talent.
Leslie, what do you make of this arena? Is it something that you think public money should be spent on?
You know, it's interesting, as Darren's just said, we have some fantastic talent, musically and otherwise, across the whole of the west of England. And where do you go? I was talking to Johnny Bruce, who's a trumpeter, the other week. He plays in a band called the Moscow Drug Club. And he was saying it's just so hard nowadays to earn. He does lots and lots of work, but he's still finding it a bit of a struggle. And you can only go so far, and then you can't go much further, because there's not the venues there. We've got lots of small music venues. We haven't got larger ones. Some 100 years or so ago, in Amsterdam, they didn't have a concert venue there. And the burghers of the city felt that they were being laughed at by the rest of Europe. So they built what's now called the Concertgebouw, which was right on the edge of the city on a piece of swampland. Of course, now it's been absorbed by Amsterdam. It's one of the most fantastic music venues in the world. If you haven't been, do go, because it's got fantastic acoustics there. Jefferson Airplane played there, but they're more noted for the orchestra, also called the Concertgebouw, which owns it as a cooperative. So
is that yes
you
or
know,
no?
Why yes or no? Why not? I think this is one thing the Metro Mayor can get involved in and help bring the money down to develop something like this. Okay. I think it's something we miss out on.
Stephen, there's a danger, Tony, here of mission creep. A big remit is being devolved to this new position, and they are big powers, and whoever's elected to them is frankly going to have their hands full on discharging those massive responsibilities. We can't have mission creep into all sorts of things that quite rightly lie with local government. I think Marvin Rees was listening to this. He'd be hopping mad at his Labour candidate colleague saying it's something that the Metro Mayor should get involved with. But just to express an opinion, as a Bristol resident, of course we should have an arena and conference venue. It's more than just you know, where we'd go and see big acts. It's about getting trade conventions to the city. Party conferences even could come to the city. And a lot of public money has been spent, yeah, to answer your question.
You're behind it.
The land was remediated by the South West Regional Development Agency, and the bridge was a grant from the coalition government.
We've got about two minutes to look at Metrobus now. I want each of you to give us your appraisal in 30 seconds each, starting with you, Darren. Metrobus, is it actually going to make any difference?
It will if it's part of an integrated transport system.
Will it be?
It has to be. That's one of the biggest challenges that we've got. Yes, absolutely needs to be part of it, because otherwise it's a complete white elephant and it will get in the way. So we have to make it work as part of an integrated transport solution.
Leslie, Metrobus, oh gosh, I mean, they've been talking about this for a long, long time. Would it make any difference? Should we have something else in trams, something like that?
Well, again, with transport, there's got to be a mixed approach, hasn't there? We've got to look at all sorts of different ways of getting people to people and people to work. It's about getting people onto public transport, onto buses. It's about getting them out of cars and onto cycles and walking. We need to, when we build new developments, ensure that we build safe cycling spaces and walking spaces as part of that. One thing I would like to see, we need to make sure, is that public transport is affordable, as well as it being economical and as well as it being greener. What I'd like to see is free bus passes for young people. It's quite interesting to hear the skills debate we had this morning with the colleges, talking about how young people can't afford to get to college, or they're having to go so far they can't get there. All of the
I'm going to have to cut you out there, because otherwise the other won't have a chance. Sorry. Metrobus, Aaron.
It's got to work. We spent over £200 million on it so far. We've got to have it, as Darren was saying, it's got to be an integrated system. We've got to have cars integrated into the system, as well as cycling, walking. It has to be integrated. If it's a standalone system, it isn't going to work. We have to integrate.
Stephen, finally, is it just a cheapo tram, and is it going to work?
It's a very expensive alternative to the tram, actually. I mean, a tram on the route that the Metrobus is going would have been so much better, but that was an opportunity screwed up several times in the past, and we are where we are.
OK, back to the Metro Mayor hustings with our rogues gallery of candidates. That is the Green Party's Darren Hall, Labour's Leslie Mansell, Lib Dem Stephen Williams and UKIP's Aaron Foote. We were talking about transport when we went into the news there. Aaron, I think maybe I'll ask you also sort of continue to talk about this, because there is talk of a congestion charge here in Bristol. Mm. I mean, that would benefit probably private firms that administer it, like Capita or IBM, who now administer the London charge. By the way, IBM, I have a particular beef with, because they helped the Gestapo administer the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. IBM did, and they're now running what some would see as a surveillance system, the congestion charge in London. They're also behind the push for diesel charging, and they manage this London congestion charge for private profit. But without wanting to make too big a thing of it, are we going to see a congestion charge here? Because I do drive around sometimes and think, this is deliberate. What they're doing is they're slowly going to say to us, we're going to have to pay to drive around like the Londoners do.
I personally not back a congestion charge or a clean air zone. And what I'd personally love to do, if elected as Metro Mayor, is campaign national government, is to actually reintroduce a scrappage scheme on dirty polluting diesels, and have it as a scale of escalating scale, so where we have a more polluting diesel being scrapped for either a hybrid or electric car, something that isn't pollutant, as in particulates, we actually have an escalating scale of you get more money for it. Why should we be always using the stick option? We have been carroted towards the fact that we have diesels are more environmentally friendly and more economically friendly for our wallets. So why should we suddenly now change tack and sort of penalise the drivers? It's, at the end of the day, it's only going to hurt the poor. Another tax on the poor. We pay absolutely huge amounts of tax in this country and we get literally no services for it.
Stephen Williams, Bristol congestion charge, is it looming on the horizon? And what do you make of this scheme to penalise people who use diesels? Because what they're talking about actually is, if you've got a brand new diesel, you've just paid £40,000 for, you won't have to pay anything. But if you've got a bit of an old banger which costs you £500, I mean, this is obviously a regressive tax of some sort.
Yeah, and it's important that people understand the different schemes that you're talking about. I've never supported a crude congestion charge for Bristol in the same way as they have in London. That is basically a road toll for entering a particular geographical area that has nothing to do with what sort of vehicle it is or what emissions it's pumping out. But I am very concerned about air quality both in Bristol and Bath, and do think you need a fiscal incentive to change people's behaviour. So I do say in my manifesto that I want the powers from central government, in order to have a licence plate recognition system linked to a charging mechanism, so that dirty polluting vehicles, starting with commercial vehicles, so lorries and vans, are deterred from entering central Bristol and central Bath and take the routes around instead. And in time, it'll sort of get them to change the sort of source of their fuel. But I'm not in favour of a crude congestion charge, because that would damage the economy of the city centre. And the most sustainable thing we can have is people living and working and enjoying time in the city centre, rather than charging people to come into the city centre. Because if we did that, more people might shop at Cribbs Causeway or go to out-of-town cinemas, and that's environmentally bad.
Oh, what about this whole business, though, of taxing people who can't afford a brand new diesel, you know, or can't pay £30,000,
£40,000? Well, as I said, Tony, I would only start it with commercial vehicles, and that's where you should start to change behaviour. And I'm sceptical about what Aaron said about scrappage charges. Maybe Darren will have something to say about this as well, because you've got to look at the life cycle of a vehicle, and scrapping a vehicle when it's still perfectly viable as a roadrunner, as it were, just because it's 10 years old or 12 years old, depends how many miles it's done. If it's still perfectly viable to be used as a vehicle for the time for another few years, then again it's environmentally bad to scrap it before it's reached the end of its operational life, because you then have a lot of crushed metal, rubber and glass and whatever, and that isn't good for the environment.
Well, in a few weeks ago I was in Singapore, where they pressed the nuclear option button there. Basically, you've got to pay £50,000 if you want to put a vehicle on the road, because they didn't want to end up like places like Beijing. But anyway, we do have a problem with congestion here in Bristol. Leslie, do you think a congestion charge is the way to go?
Well, I think there's other options we can look at. So, for example, I'd like to see flexible working brought in, which may work for some people, might not work for others. But I worked on a project, I headed it up at Bristol Council some years ago. Now, I live 22 odd miles from where I work. I live in Radstock and I work at Southmead Hospital. It can take me 2 hours or more to get to work and to get home.
So is that 4 hours in the car each day?
It can be. So, you know, lots of people that are putting up with these horrendous journeys. It's costing us £350 million a year. So we've got to look at congestion. We need some different ideas. We need some new ideas. And some of them don't necessarily cost. You have to look at flexible working in the broadest possible definition. For example, our nurses wouldn't be able to work at home. That wouldn't be feasible. But for more of the admin stuff, it may be possible. And what it needs is good management to make that effective. So it's just one way that we could do something a bit different. And also, what we are going to see, and we're hearing more and more of this now, as batteries become better developed, then there's an opportunity to have electric cars. So they should hopefully be less polluting one way or another.
But they're not going to stop the congestion, are they?
No, well they won't. But the thing is, like I say, unless we start looking at some other options. If you look at, you know, the buses were deregulated by Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative government, and what happened? We lost a lot of our services out in the rural areas. For lots of people, they can't get anywhere. For Freedom Youth, just to give a concrete example, where buses were being cut out to the rural areas, for young people coming into Bristol for services, then it was very difficult for them to get home, and they may not wish to ask parents to take them, especially when it's not an organisation that's supporting them because of their sexual orientation, which they can't discuss at home.
Anyway, Darren, Bristol congestion charge will benefit private firms like Capita or IBM. It's a slightly unbiased the question because I'm not sure that the congestion is genuine. It doesn't look to me as if the real efforts have been made through something like a tram rather than metro bus to actually address this. But anyhow, what do you make of this, and is it something that you would approve if you were doing this job?
Well, the first point is to be clear about that we want a clean air zone. That's the priority, and actually the air quality issues are in quite a small area. So having some punitive congestion charge over some, you know, boundary around the city centre isn't what I'm talking about. I don't think it's what other people are talking about either. Yeah. What we've been saying on the campaign is that we're all pretty much in agreement about the need to tackle air quality. And see, there's an alarm telling us that we need to do it.
The quality of the air in this studio is not good enough. Yeah, Open the window.
So, Stephen's right. We absolutely need to tackle the biggest polluters first. The other thing, so large diesels, the buses need to be dealt with. And
so that'll mean bus fares go up, won't it?
No, because it's part of the system where we shift over to a cleaner, greener, integrated transport system. So bus fares don't need to go up, part of the rolling change of the vehicles that are used in the city centre. The other thing to point out is that as urban living changes, fewer people are going to buy cars. They're going to share them. Almost certainly going to share access to, firstly, renewably powered vehicles, and secondly, vehicles that are driverless. So we are on the verge of a transport revolution. The start of this for Bristol and Bath is a clean air zone, also called a living heart. I really like that idea for Bristol and Bath, to have this living heart idea.
OK, let's have another little round here, because I think we've brought up some other questions. Do you think that, Stephen, do you think the Williams, Lib Dem, do you think the oil industry will allow us to get rid of our cars? They seem to quite like the way that they make lots of profits every time we drive around.
Well, we live in a democracy, believe it or not, and you're very cynical, Tony, and actually the person who's elected to this position will decide what's going to happen, whether a clean air zone with bite, which is what Darren and I are talking about, will be achieved or not. I don't think BP or ExxonMobil are going to tell me what to do. Donald Trump may welcome them into their administration, but they're not going to be part of our administration.
Leslie.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because one business making one set of profits is not going to want to give that up very easily. Having said that, the Metro Mayor will have an opportunity to draw more funding into the area, as I said before, for things like an arena or whatever else is agreed. Because at the end of the day, the three local authorities will be deciding what they want. The Metro Mayor doesn't have omnipotent rule in this particular case. But if we look at things like congestion charging, in Nottingham, what they've done, rather than a congestion charge, they brought in a car parking charge for people working in the city. They paid for their tram with that. And I think if that was fair and reasonable, people wouldn't mind as much. And also in this area, I think there's about £200 million, I'm not quite sure of the figure, that's been brought in for the West of England to bring in walking and cycling. So lots of businesses, and I know our hospital signs up to that as well. So we can look at the type of things we can do, the sorts of initiatives to bring about some change, and it can be a small step at a time to get to somewhere bigger later.
Okay, well, I mean, when we're talking about transport, we ought to talk about some of the things which really do affect people quite a lot. One of those is potholes, because the quality of our roads is
don't get me started on potholes.
Absolutely,
please don't get me started on potholes.
Because
it's not
I mean,
responsibility of the Metro Man.
I mean, there are I mean, since this is, I mean, part of your responsibility is transport. I just like to hear. I mean. What would you, Darren, is there anything that you think can be done? Because the quality of our roads is absolutely appalling. I mean, been to several other parts of the world recently, including Europe. We have great big holes in our roads and no one seems to care.
Yeah, well, ironically, of course, by banning large diesel vehicles from the city centre, that will help, because a lot of the damage is being done by repeated tracking across by large vehicles. The other issue...
Yeah, they don't pay their fair share of tax either, do they, the big vehicles?
No,
yeah.
And I mean, there's a small opportunity here to bring climate change into the debate, because the worse the weather, the more temperature changes and the heavier rainfall is going to mean that we need to spend more on roads. Now, unfortunately, one of the impacts of government cuts is repairing the roads, and that is a direct result of government cuts, where the budget is discretionary and local authorities are having to use that money on other things, and they are delaying and delaying until we all start screaming about it and saying something's got to be done.
Well, I wonder whether people buy these big SUVs and 4x4s because they're fed up with the potholes. Leslie, what do you make since this is your pet subject?
I can't speak for why other people buy a particular vehicle, but one of the issues is that the infrastructure, and the Metro Mayor will have responsibility for infrastructure. If we're going to have more people cycling, we've got to have the surfaces that they can cycle on that are safe. I actually saw a woman come off a bike going down Park Street the other day, and she'd hit a pothole. You couldn't see what had gone on for a start, because she was cycling down the road quite happily, and all of a sudden she was on the floor. And my campaign manager, Tim, he's given up cycling at night, because he said it's just too dangerous because of all the potholes. You know, we've got to sort something out. We can't have one thing out and not another. We've got to look at these things holistically, and we've got to look at these things together to take things forward and do them in a different way.
Aaron, what do you make of the pothole? It's probably more a rural problem, possibly, than it is an urban one.
I don't think it's just necessarily a rural... It's an issue across the whole board. And in fact, potholes are there, and it is what we've got to look at. But it's not part of the remit of the Metro Mayor, unfortunately. But going forward, I would like to actually see a transit system that is linked all up, so we don't have these bus lanes or cycle lanes that suddenly appear and end. We've got to have a cycle lane that carries on, and where it is actually properly maintained and kept up together, because we need to get people on bikes and walking. It is part of what we have to have. We have to have a coherent and netted transit system, and we can only do that by actually having correct road surfaces.
Now, Stephen's turn. Hang on, Leslie. Stephen's turn now. Is this something that keeps you awake at night, pothole, Stephen?
I wouldn't say it keeps me awake at night, but obviously it's frustrating. I'm not a frequent cyclist, you want to put it that way, but do drive around, and I have a small car, so potholes are infuriating. But I do think sometimes local authorities need to spend their highways budget more wisely. Just to give you an example that infuriates thousands of people who live in St Andrews, Bishopston and Redland, some utterly pointless so-called traffic calming measures were put in at the junction of Cromwell Road and North Road in St Andrews, narrowing the junction so the people turning out of Cheltenham Road who want to go up Cromwell Road now have to wait a long time, quite unnecessarily, causing congestion, causing air pollution, supposedly to make the route safer for cyclists. But they put it on the wrong side of the road, so the cyclists are coming on the wrong side of the road up a one-way
street.
Well,
you've reminded me...
Whoever designed that, frankly, something painful,
Stephen,
to be done to their career.
<You've>
They've wasted a lot of money. I just to finish the point. The reason I thought of potholes, so that's my route home normally, from coming from the city centre, is that North Road and Cromwell Road have a lot of potholes on them, and if they just addressed that, they would have made far more people much happier, including cyclists.
Well, you've reminded me of what I call the bonkers bus stops, when they started moving all these bus stops right out into the middle of the road. So I really feel for poor cyclists who have to go into oncoming traffic just to get past a bus. I'm sure there was some kind of logic behind it, but it's bad for cyclists. Anyway, Leslie, you wanted to come back in.
Just quickly, one thing that the Metro Mayor will be doing is coordinating between the three local authorities, and in fact with North Somerset as well on certain things. But there was, I'm not sure which way round this was now, there was green cycle lanes and red cycle lanes. Some were in Bristol and some were in South Gloss, but they didn't join up. So if you got on a cycle in Bristol and went through to South Gloss, and all of a sudden the whole thing disappeared, it just wasn't joined up. Now surely, you know, instead of joining up roadworks like we usually do, why didn't we just join up the cycle lanes? it was such an easy thing to do, and it's one thing that the Metro Mayor can get involved in and trying to get some better and more efficient ways of getting around.
Well, surely the cyclists can just cycle across some farmland until they reach the other cycle lane.
Have you ever tried it on a bike on a rutted field, on a ploughed field?
Well, at least we don't do here what they do in Russia, which is when they get a traffic jam on the run on the motorway, they will just drive off the side of the motorway and across the farmland until they find they've gone past the traffic jam, and they get back on the motorway again that way.
You struggle with that in a robbing reliant, wouldn't
you? You certainly would. Anyway, another part of the responsibility of the Metro Mayor is going to be boosting employment and economic growth. So I'd like to start with you this time, Stephen Williams, Lib Dems. How will you boost employment and economic growth? It's one thing we desperately need in this country. Up until the late 1970s, we had pretty much full employment. Everyone found it easy to get a job. If they didn't like their boss, or if their boss bullied them or messed them around, they could just leave and find another one straight away. Why can't we do that anymore, and what are you going to do to sort it out?
Well, employment law certainly isn't going to be in the remit of the Metro Mayor, but local economic development certainly is, and in fact that's the primary reason why these posts have been created. And I'm glad that at 21 minutes past six we've started discussing why this position has been created. The good news is that we have a very prosperous region. We're the most prosperous region outside London, so we start from a good position. But the downside of that is that the prosperity is not evenly shared, either socially or geographically. I mean, Leslie's mentioned she comes from Radstock, so the towns and villages south of the region do not share fairly in that prosperity. More needs to be done to make sure that inward investment comes into some of our communities and into our inner city deprived areas as well, such as St Paul's and the area where we're broadcasting from here in Lawrence Hill or in Twerton and other parts of Bath. So I want to rebalance the economy using the money and powers that are available that you've mentioned, the $30 million a year local economic development fund, but also the soft power of the Metro Mayor to get employers around the table to solve some of the intractable problems of some communities having endemic worklessness through several generations, and opening up opportunities to those people. And the final thing that the Metro Mayor will certainly be able to do, and this is very important, my fellow candidates can now all shout bingo, is that Brexit is going to make this a lot harder. So as regional mayor, I would want to have a Brexit plan to make sure that we prepare for the worst, because I do think it's going to be the worst that happens if we go down Theresa May's hard Brexit route, to plan for the skills gaps that we're going to have, what retraining opportunities we're going to have to do locally if our hospitality industry and our aerospace industries are going to survive, and to lead the trade delegations are going to be even more vital to make sure we get more inward investment into the region.
Okay, Stephen. Darren, what do you make of this responsibility, boosting employment and economic growth? How are you going to do that?
Well, it is unfortunate, I think, that this devolution agenda has been so singularly focused on economic growth, because I believe that prosperity, A, is a better word to describe what we want to achieve, and I say that because, B, there is more to life than GDP. We know this in the west of England. It's about quality of life. Now, there are two issues about that. One is that not everybody is able to enjoy a good quality of life. So that's absolutely one of the criteria. We've got to focus first and foremost on helping people back into work and helping people who are in work that is at risk of being taken away from them, zero-hours contracts, those kind of things. And I would like to see our region become a beacon for a real living wage. So that's one issue. Secondly, I think there is a real opportunity for businesses to get more involved in helping to skill up young people and older people who are struggling to survive in this economy. Now, part of the devolution agenda allows us to have a conversation with business that says, what are you going to do to directly help those people that you want to get into the workforce? And I think that's a massive opportunity for the west of England to buck the trend around what is the focus for the government's agenda and say, over the next 20 to 30 years, what do we want the future of our economy to look like? We want it to be more equal, and we want it to be more diverse and resilient.
So that's Darren Hall for the Greens. Leslie Mansell for the Labour Party. How are you going to do this? Boosting economic growth and employment. I mean, this is something that those of us who are old enough can remember when it was actually fairly easy to just get a job, and that job would pay the rent, pay the electricity bills, etc. And nowadays, that seems like a forgotten dream.
Yes, there's been a huge turnaround, hasn't there? We've now got people on 0 hours contracts, we've now got people on minimum wage, and what I want to see, it's in my manifesto, I want to see a West of England living wage, and that needs to tie up then with housing, so we've got a living rent, so people can afford to pay for where they're living. If you look at some recent figures that have come out, growth, and I know Darren just said GDP shouldn't get focused on it, but growth is 0.3%. If the economy is going to survive, and if we're going to get things out of that economy, it's got to grow at around 3%, so we're nowhere near getting there. And at the same time, we've got a culture of absolute inept waste by the Conservative government, who, as I said earlier on, £500 million on homelessness, and yet, Tony, you just said it would cost £44 million alone just to sort out homelessness and support people. There's a gap there. We could do some things better. We could do things differently. What I want to see also is that we make sure that people have got the right jobs for them, and that we ensure that they go up that skills ladder, because what we do is we tend not to do that, and what happens is then that we're missing out on the skills and the talents that people have. So it's not just black and minority ethnic people in this region that are losing out, women are losing out. We've got the biggest pay gap despite the Equal Pay Act of 1970. We still have a massive pay gap between women and men, and that's not just full-time work, that's part-time work as well.
Okay.
So again, it's not a single approach, it's a multitude of things we need to do to sort this out.
Well, one thing that occurs to me, you're talking about women's employment rates and not getting paid the rate for the job, is that back in the 1970s you only had to have one member of the household going out. Nowadays, often you need to have two people going out to work, both husband and wife or whatever. Anyway, Aaron, what do you make of this? I mean, this is a knotty one, isn't it? Boosting employment and economic growth.
Obviously, I agree with Darren quite on this one. We're being measured on GDP. I think it'd be quite nice to be measured on happiness, to be honest. And I think that'd be quite a way forward and a change for us. But obviously, we've got to look at the Metro Mayor Devolution Pack. It's been designed around GDP and growth. We've got to work with businesses and local people. And I want to work with local people through an e-democracy platform to find out what skills and what they want to achieve from this. We've got to work with employers as well and find out how we can get more apprenticeships. It's key. Let's train people. By training people, we will actually get more GDP, we will get more output, and we'll make people eventually in the long run happier and more coherent societies.
Well, I mean, it may be a bit unfair to single you out, Aaron, but yes. I noticed this week that the UK Independence Party has decided to make some sort of decision about whether the people should be allowed to wear burqas and this kind of thing. I mean, it does seem as if you're singling out one minority community.
I'm quite happy to comment on this one quite easily, to be honest. I'm along the same lines as Bill Etheridge and Jim Carver, to be quite honest. I don't agree with this draconian rule that's coming from our party, and I'm quite happy to stand up to this one. And unfortunately for us in UKIP, we don't have whips, so we don't have to listen to party politics all the time. And I will not be listening to the burqa ban.
Okay, thanks. Also, I think we've got another subject area that the Metro Mayor is going to be responsible for is adult education. I mean, I wasn't really aware that there was that much adult education going on. Certainly, you know, that seems to be something that's been run down over the last 30, 40 years. But maybe we'll start with you again, Aaron.
Yes.
Adult education, we certainly do. People do need to change horses in midstream sometimes, change careers. It's not just about what you learn at school anymore or at university. So what will you be doing to make sure that their adult education opportunities are there?
I think we can look at what's happened. It's not a job for life anymore. We don't go out into the workplace now and to be a farmer is still probably normally a job for life, but to be like a coal person or to be a shop assistant or to be actually in higher education, it's not the job for life anymore. We change and we adapt to our current needs, so we've got to model our education system around that with higher education. We've got to work with the people of the West of England here, and this is why I think e-democracy is key, because we will find out what people want and need, and they can decide how their taxes are spent on that.
Darren, what do you make of this part of your responsibility? Are you actually going to be able to make sure that people can get new education, increase their education, get retrained if they want to?
Yes, I think we can make a real difference in this area, actually. And we had a very useful meeting this morning with the principals, chief executives of the various colleges around the region. And they were pointing out, quite rightly, that there is a small budget which is going to be directly administered through the Metro Mayor process. But there's a much bigger pot that needs to be looked at in order to create a... they were quoting £170 million worth of process around adult education. What emerged from that for me was the relationship between the education process and the businesses that are looking for people to be employed in their business. And there was an acceptance by all of those people around the room, including Business West, who were there to represent regional business, in saying they have a role to play in filling the gap that has emerged from the lack of government funding, because they've got a really good incentive to help train young people and to retrain people who are looking for a change in career, to not only fill the skills gap they've got at the moment, but also the likely skills gap that is going to appear because of Brexit.
Now, Leslie, another question here is, will people be able to afford to get retrained? I mean, because most of the education we're being offered now, certainly outside of secondary schools, beyond that, everyone is having to pay for it.
Well, this is a really complex question, isn't it? I mean, what I find in the hospital, we have a real struggle with basic skills training. So we struggle to recruit healthcare assistants because they can't get past their level one maths and English. What we also find we've got a gap in is maths teachers. Now, it doesn't take a lot to add two and two together on that one. But the issue is there. How are we going to bring all this together so that we can make sure that we've got the best access for most people? And part of the devolution deal is about ensuring that people are the furthest from the job market, including disabled people, have got more access. What we're seeing is cuts to things like advice centres, who provide support to people who struggle to fill in a job application because they can't read and write. We haven't got that basic skills in place, and we're losing the advice centres, and the colleges are not doing, because that money was cut from the budget again by the Conservatives. Then, you know, our hands are tied all the time. So the meeting we had this morning with the college principals was really interesting, and I think there's a lot that the Metro Mayor can do there. It's not built in naturally, the skills agenda, and there's certainly things in my manifesto, and certainly something that I want to make a priority along with all the others.
Stephen Williams, what do you make of this? Will you be able to actually get adult education up and running again? It doesn't seem like there's that much around these days.
Well, it's another opportunity to influence locally what is currently decided nationally. So I think that is a step forward we should not lose sight of over all of these policy areas. But it's not a responsibility that's devolved until May 2018. So what I've said in my manifesto, which I would like people to read online on my website, stephenwilliams.org.uk, and they'll find a full section there on the economy, transport, housing, skills, Brexit, and my approach to devolution.
And you'll find links to Stephen's website and the others' websites on thisweek.org, since we're doing websites, thisweek.org.uk. I'll make sure they're all on there, Stephen.
Great, good. And in the skills section, I've said I would spend time in the first year as being the regional mayor before these responsibilities are transferred, meeting with all the colleges, and three of us had a start with that this morning, and all the private sector skills providers as well. But critically, employers, particularly in the sort of growth areas of the future, what I hope will be the growth areas of the future, depending on how much damage Brexit does, to make sure that the skills that are on offer to adults are aligned with what the opportunities are going to be over the next 5 or 10 years, so that we get that proper pathway into work as a result of spending what is, yes, a scarce resource.
Well, as in case you hadn't noticed, there's been also a general election called a couple of weeks ago. Theresa May has a majority. So why has she called it now? Is it a second Brexit vote? And will we be seeing Bristol's first Green MP in Bristol West? There are some people that think we may. We'll have a discussion about that with our Metro Mayor guests in a minute. But first, we've got a clip from Prime Minister's Questions, the last one before the general election in June, with Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn talking about education and austerity.
Mr. Speaker, when I became Leader of the Opposition 18 months ago, I said I wanted people's voices to be heard in Parliament. So, Mr. Speaker, instead of just speaking to hand-picked audiences who can't ask questions, I hope the Prime Minister won't mind if she answers some questions today from the public.
Give it a try.
I start, Mr. Speaker, with Christopher, who wrote to me this week, and he says, in the last 5 years, my husband has had only a 1% increase in his wages. The cost of living has risen each year. We now have at least 15% less buying power than them. So where is Christopher and his husband's share in the stronger economy?
Yep.
Minister!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I first of all join the Right Honourable Gentleman in commending those colleagues who are leaving the House for the service that they have shown to their constituents and to Parliament over the years. Can I also say a huge thank you to the staff of the House of Commons and of Parliament who support us in the work that we do here in this chamber and elsewhere. I will come on to the point about, I note by the way that the Right Honourable Gentleman didn't take the opportunity to stand up and show how he would actually stand up for the defence of our country. Once again, he missed that opportunity. I note what the Right Honourable Gentleman is saying about wages increasing. I see today that he is talking about paying for extra wage increases in the National Health Service. I think we should first of all recognise, actually, that for people working in the National Health Service, around half of those staff, because of progression and basic pay increases, will actually see on average a pay increase of 4% in their title. What we know, and what I can say to Christopher, is that he will have a choice at the next election. A choice between the strong and stable leadership of the Conservatives, which will secure our economy for the future, and a Labour Party which would crash our economy, which would mean less money for public services, and the ordinary working families would pay the price.
I think I should ask you to start there, Leslie, since that was aimed, that reply from Theresa May, directly at you. And the Labour Party apparently is going to crash the economy.
Well, what nonsense. I mean, this is what the Conservatives have been doing all the time they've been in office. I mean, the Labour Party didn't crash the economy before. It's a myth to say that they did. It actually grew the economy and reduced the national debt, whereas with the Conservatives, we've had absolutely the opposite. At the moment, we've now got personal debt standing at almost £2 trillion. You know, I've got no idea the size of that. I've got no idea what a trillion looks like. But what's happening is wages are absolutely stagnating. People are probably not earning any more now than they were in 2008, unless they're the chief executive of a company, in which case by the 4th of January they will have earned more than most people earn all year. So it's an absolute nonsense. What we're living in at the moment is a casino economy where money is being sucked out into tax havens rather than going into public services. And with regard to the NHS, I started working the NHS in 2009. I didn't have a pay rise for 4 years. When we got that pay rise, it was 1% and it wasn't consolidated. So what that means is that we didn't get any pension added to that. And I'm not the only person that works in the health service. It's the biggest employer in the country. So if we're not paying people an appropriate wage, how on earth are they managing, especially if they're only on a minimum wage, when they're possibly, if they're working full-time, they're possibly earning around £14,000-£15,000 a year.
Leslie, what about the other questions, though? Why has May called this election now, and is it a second Brexit vote?
Well, I think there's lots of reasons it's being called. One of the reasons is because a number of Conservative MPs are about to be taken to court regarding their election expenses, which is a serious
offence. So do you have inside information from the Crown Prosecution Service that they are going to be charged?
Well, what I'm saying is that was what was happening. I don't have inside information, clearly I don't, but it looked like the government were going to lose its majority, which is only it's only very small.
About 17, so, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, so they were going to lose 36 MPs. I do think it's an issue about Brexit, because Theresa May went to Europe and demanded several things, including a trade deal, and the 27 countries in the EU said go away in no uncertain terms, because they weren't going to be bullied. If I'm a trade union rep, I have been for 30 odd years, you don't go in and demand and thump the table. That's not the way you get anything out of anybody.
Okay.
You need to go in and negotiate. So yes, it's about Brexit, yes, it's about what those MPs did, and yes, it's about the company screwing up the economy.
Stephen Williams, do you think it's about a second Brexit referendum, and why has Theresa May called this general election?
I think there should be another opportunity for the people to give their verdict on Brexit.
But
finish my sentence. But the right time to give that is not May 2017, when Theresa May is just embarking on her tortuous negotiations with the European Union. It should be at the end of it, when we know what Brexit looks like, because at the moment we don't. We've got a clue from her Lancaster House speech, and it looks pretty awful. It looks like it's going to be an extreme Brexit that's catapulted out of the single market, out of the customs union, with lesser status than Norway and Turkey, for goodness sake. And I don't think a lot of people who voted Leave thought that's what they were going to be getting. But the right time for the British people to make a judgment of that, either in a general election or in a standalone referendum, would have been in early 2019, when we get to that point. The reason I think she's called it now is not for that. It's because the Labour Party, frankly, is going to get screwed. Jeremy Corbyn is probably the most disastrous Labour leader of my lifetime, and I got interested in politics when Michael Foot was leader of the Labour Party. I come from a Welsh mining community just along from where he was the MP, in fact. And the reason I didn't join the Labour Party at that time, which a lot of people assumed I should have done, was because the Labour Party was a mess. It was a left-wing total nonsense, the lost touch with ordinary working people. Jeremy Corbyn has taken it even further to the left, supported by people like Leslie Mansell sitting next to me at the moment. That's why Theresa May has seen naked opportunity here to crush the Labour Party, have a huge Tory victory, and that's the awful prospect that awaits us on June the 8th. And that's why it's important the Lib Dems gain a lot of the seats that we lost to the Conservatives, particularly here in the West Country.
Leslie, before we hear from UKIP and from the Greens, it looks like you wanted to come back there.
Well, actually, what a load of nonsense that we've just heard. Jeremy Corbyn is actually being well supported on the doorstep, and I've been on the doorstep now since last January. So while there are some people that have been sucked in by the media hype, lots of people understand that Jeremy Corbyn put forward 10 pledges. Those 10 pledges adopted by the Labour Party are around having secure homes, having secure jobs, having public services, having justice and equality, and they all sign up to that. In fact, most people do, and I think the Tories are going to be in for a big shock come the 9th of June.
Aaron Foot, as a UKIP candidate, yep. What do you make of this general election being called? Because Theresa May does have her majority. Do you see it as a second Brexit vote?
No, I see it as a diluted Brexit vote, to be honest. I think she's being smart moved here. She's promised not to call a snap election. She now has, so she's reversing on her promises, which I think she's just going to carry on by diluting the true Brexiteers in her party. She's going to have a big mandate. We're not going to lie about this. She's going to have an absolute massive majority. She can then ignore the true Brexiteers like Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, and even our local North Somerset MP. She can ignore them. She won't need their votes. So it's going to be about diluting Brexit, and it's probably going to be about reversing Brexit, to be honest.
Darren Hall from the Greens, what do you make of it? Why has Theresa May called this? She already got her majority.
I think there's no doubt in my mind that there is a significant section of the Conservative parties who are arrogant. They are autocratic. They're egotistical, and they couldn't resist what they saw as an opportunity to push their luck. And I really hope that there is a resurgence of people Remainers who come back out and say, do you know what, this is not what we voted for. We certainly didn't vote for extreme Brexit. I think
you're saying that she's looking at the polls being so positive towards the Conservatives that that's why she's called it, do you think? Because we've seen, haven't we, with both Brexit and other elections, that polls aren't always reliable. And the Trump election, obviously.
No, and that's why I really hope that they're going to get a shock. And I, you know, the Green Party support Lib Dems in their pursuit of making sure there is an opportunity for a democratic vote on the result of the deal. That's actually when the referendum should have been. Now, it's the because people were lied to consistently through this process. They were duped by this process. They were unable to make a reasonable decision. And all that talk of saying the vast majority, that was absolute rubbish, where this margin has been turned into a landslide for something we didn't even know what we were voting for.
Now, when it comes to the general election, are you in favour of electoral pacts in order to maybe stand aside in one constituency or another?
I am very clear on supporting Progressive Alliance. I think it's absolutely essential, one, to make sure that we get rid of this Tory government, and secondly, that we move towards a PR voting process for the UK. We have to get rid of first past the post, because we're never going to get a better kind of politics in the UK unless we tackle the establishment and the lobbying and the big business, all that stuff that is so bad about our democratic processes.
Can I say, I agree with Darren. I don't want to see a majority Tory government on June 8th, let alone one with a landslide victory. And I do wish parties on the centre and left, over many decades, in fact, had got themselves sorted out on this and had agreed on electoral reform was ultimately in their interest. It's the Labour Party that really needs to make the big move
on this,
not the Liberal Democrats
or
the Green Party. Well, there's no prospect of a coalition, because it's quite clear that Theresa May and the Conservatives are going to win by a substantial majority. There's no coalition on offer at all. I must say, though, to Darren, well, he and I personally agree, and we've discussed this, and I've discussed this with a lot of friends in the Green Party, that this ought to be the way that we go. Thus far in the general election, it's not too late, nominations haven't even opened, let alone closed yet. The only party that said it will stand down anyway is the Liberal Democrats, and we've said it in Brighton, that we will stand down in favour of Caroline Lucas. We have made the first move. I'm very disappointed to have read on social media, so it may not be accurate, while we've been sitting here, that the response of the Green Party in Sussex is to say they're going to fight every seat, including Lewis, which is right next door to Brighton, where the Liberal Democrats very narrowly lost to the Conservatives last time. That's not a good start, frankly.
Leslie, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I think we're in a position where we cannot trust the Tories anymore with our economy. I talked earlier on about where the money's going. If you look at something like personal independent payments, that budget is overspent. We spent £700 million giving it to two companies that haven't managed to do the job yet. In the meantime, people are suffering. We're seeing people commit suicide. So I don't agree at all that Labour is on the back foot. I think Labour is on the front foot. And I think Stephen Williams' assertion, I mean, he keeps making these betting predictions, and, I'm not too sure he's always going to be right on them. So as far as I'm concerned, the Metro Mayor election is absolutely crucial next week. Please put your vote against Labour. And then the general election, please do the same. Because if not, you're going to be voting for more austerity, less services. And if you go the other way, then please, please pick prosperity. That's the way we need to go.
Finally, with you, Aaron, it's worth mentioning that I don't think UKIP has any MPs now. I mean, is this really the end of the party? Because it
Definitely
does look
not.
As if the whole Brexit thing has been voted for, and that's goodbye to UKIP.
No, definitely not. I think you'll find in the general election that we will probably pick up one or two seats that we will be targeting. That we will have a target in list, and we will actually stick to it this time. Where we went wrong last time in the general election, I'll quite happily hold my hand up, as we had our expectations too high. We targeted too many seats, and we didn't do what the Lib Dems did, and that is be absolutely fantastic and super hyper local. So we have to start doing that, and we have done that. We have championed change where we have got these council seats, where we have actually making change now by holding councils and holding people to account.
Also, on the whole thing of polls and elections, this isn't really anything to do with the Metro Mayor whatsoever, but I wonder, starting with you, Darren, do you have any views on President Trump and British foreign policy?
Yeah, I certainly do have some views I don't want to disrespect the role of president, but I do struggle to put the word in front of his name, to be honest. I think this was a triumph of the worst kind of politics, you know, the social media, the far right rhetoric. It was a dreadful moment. I'm really glad to see that Europe is. It looks like it's going to stand firm against this kind of stuff. We have to, because the world, all of a sudden, like almost overnight, feels like a more dangerous place. Because of the kind of language and the kind of attitude that Trump brings to global politics. And the first 100 days has just seen a plethora of mistakes and broken promises and, dare I say it, you know, Islamophobia for sure. So I'm utterly horrified, heartbroken, terrified on occasion, and I hope we can, as quickly as possible, get back to a global society that understands that hope is better than fear, peacekeeping is more important than warmongering, etc., etc.
Aaron Foote, yeah. Do you have any views on President Trump and British foreign policy?
Yeah, I quite happily answer this question, because originally I did support him because I thought he was going to stop the sort of police in the world policy that Obama and the other politicians...
Well, he did say he would, didn't he? He wouldn't do any more foreign interventions.
Yeah, and he's failed on that.
And then suddenly North Korea happened.
Yeah, now he's failed on that, and he's, personally, he's gone absolutely right down to the bottom of my list, and I don't support him one bit no more.
Stephen Williams.
Well, that's it. I wonder if Nigel Farage will be endorsing you, Aaron, in future elections, because he quite obviously feels rather differently. I agree with everything Darren said. I think Trump is a total disaster.
The American people did vote for him.
No. Well, they didn't. Hillary Clinton got the most votes. Let's not forget that. And it was significant as well.
But you see, we have a first past the post system here, don't we? Which you have to manoeuvre, and there has to be tactical voting. Mm. And so, obviously, a party, someone that's going to win, has got to understand the system and play the system. It's not fair.
But let's not lose sight of the fact that Hillary Clinton got, I think, more than at least 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. So let's not assume that the American people made a collective mad decision. They didn't, but the Electoral College frustrated that result in the same way as our first-past-the-post system frustrates what the British people vote for in election after election. But if ever the metaphor bull in a china shop was appropriate, I mean, it's appropriate here, and the china shop is world order. And that's what really ought to worry all of us, as Trump sort of flounders about and blunders into different situations, can't be sure one minute whether he's in favour of NATO or against NATO, which general he's listening to, whether he thinks Kim Jong-un is actually a good bloke trying to sort out a difficult situation, or whether he's a dangerous despot. It seems to move on a daily basis, and that is frightening. I'm making light of it, but it is frankly frightening. This man is the most important human being on the planet. I don't think he's particularly well equipped to do the job.
Leslie Mansell for Labour, what do you make of Donald Trump, and what thoughts have you got on British foreign policy?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Donald Trump made lots and lots of claims which seem to have come off the hoof rather from any kind of evidence, similar to what we've had with the Brexit argument. Apparently he's just backed down on the wall, so there's no longer going to be a wall. As Metro Mayor, I want to see a wall around the west of England, because I think we need to stop our talent getting out. Sorry, that is a joke.
Stop the underground M32 again.
I think the other issue is that for Donald Trump, I mean, make no mistake, he's been first into Europe trying to negotiate a trade deal. And that's one of the things that Theresa May went in and demanded and got told to go away, because that's not the way they work. So Donald Trump is there, unfortunately. He appealed to the poorest voters, those that were without jobs, those that were struggling. And I think that's a section of the population. It's quite understandable when they say, hey, we want things differently. But we don't get things differently, do we? We have the Tories coming time and time again, try and convince us through their cultural hegemony that what we need is something we need them, when in actual fact, we don't. And let's face it, this austerity is not working. Even the CBI was saying austerity is not working. And let's face it, Liberal Democrats, when they were in coalition, they were supporting those austerity measures. We've got to stop. We've got to do something different.
Final question, really quick, if you can manage to answer in half a minute, that would be helpful. Starting with you, Aaron Foote, yep. For UKIP, what are the best and worst things about Bristol City Region?
Oh, the best is obviously we've got amazing talent and amazing location. I think the worst thing is the potholes and transport system.
Okay, Darren.
The best thing is the potential economics for everyone, and the proximity to the beach. I came back here because I can get to the beach to go surfing within 2 hours.
Which beach?
North Devon.
Oh, okay, not Western Super Mud.
No, but and the worst thing about it is its inequality.
Leslie Mansell, best and worst things about the region.
I think the best thing within the region is the diversity, and also it's such a beautiful part of the world to live in. And the worst thing really is the congestion.
Okay, well, Stephen Williams, what do you make of those two questions about our region?
I think the best thing is that the two cities of Bath and Bristol are fantastic places that people from all over the world have heard of for different reasons, and as regional mayor I would want to bring them together and market them jointly, because I think we've got a world-beating brand in terms of what they can offer as a World Heritage City, and for Bristol, a quirky, diverse city that does things differently. I think that's something fantastic. But what despairs me about Bristol in particular, I agree with my colleagues about inequality, but frankly the public transport is woeful and lets us down, and that's the big challenge for whoever is elected to this post.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests, the Green Party, Darren Hall, Labour's Leslie Mansell, Lib Dem, Stephen Williams and UKIP's Aaron Foote. Apology from the Conservative Tim Bowles, who's looking after his minister today, and the independent candidate John Savage, whose job as chairman of United Hospitals Bristol's NHS Trust called him away. And thanks to studio engineer Sadiv Satan. Where will you be on Sunday night, Steve? Beltane it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Will you be down in Glastonbury? Up on the Brocken? No? Okay. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, the iPlayer or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable long May Day weekend on BCFM with Billy Quain's Saturday Edition Arts Show tomorrow morning, 10 till 12. And the real music...
Presented by Steve Satan
tomorrow, we hear. And the real musical deal... Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 1972, Chrissie Hynde and Mood Swings. Do please join me at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.